From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When Steve Jobs first revealed the iPad to the world in 2010, he waxed on like he did about the device. Extraordinary, phenomenal, everyone should have one. What he didn't say at the time, though he admitted later, is he wouldn't let his own kids use the iPad. And he wasn't the only tech baron who limited technology at home. And why? This is one of the questions Adam Alter gets at in his new book. Here's how he puts it. Why are the world's greatest public technocrats also its greatest private technophobes? It's because they know just how addictive this technology can be. Alter has written a book about addictive behavior and how gadgets and apps are designed to get you hooked. He'll join us today to talk about how this addiction works and how you kick it, or at least minimize it. His book is called Irresistible, after the news.
Hey, Radio West listener. We thought you'd want to know that the book we're talking about on today's podcast just happens to be available on Audible. Go to RadioWest.org and you'll find a link included with the show, along with links to IndieBound and Amazon, and any purchases you make through these affiliate partners help support Radio West. Thanks so much.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Adam Alter's book is about how the technology industry uses what they know of human behavior to get people hooked on gadgets and apps. But really, the book is about addiction or addictive behaviors. And Alter says addiction, whether it's drugs or a smartphone, is about environment and circumstance, and that the environment and circumstance we're in right now is more conducive, he says, to addiction than anything humans have ever experienced in our history. So his book traces the rise of these addictive behaviors. He explores the psychological tricks designers use. The book, though, is also about how we can get a grip on this addiction. We'll never abstain from technology. Most of us won't anyway. So Alter talks about how we can learn to at least cope or limit our addiction to a screen. The book is called Irresistible, The Rise of Addictive Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. Adam Alter is an associate professor of psychology and marketing at New York University's Stern School of Business. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, the New Yorker, the Atlantic, as long as many others. He's joining us today from a studio in New York City. And Adam Alter, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me on the show, Doug.
I want to begin with a question of, when you're teaching, what are your expectations for your students in terms of their phones? What do you say to them? But do you say, turn them off, don't bring them in here, put them away? What do you say to students that's realistic?
My classroom is tech-free, but it's actually very easy for me to do that because NYU has a policy, at least in the business school, that students are not allowed to use laptops. Smartphones have to be turned off and out of sight at all times. And so I just adopt that default policy. And the reason for that is that you actually learn better when you don't have those devices around. Yeah. So it's really easy for me. I don't have to do much at all.
What got you started thinking about all of this, the idea? And when did it occur to you that this was a behavioral addiction?
I think like so many psychologists, we get our ideas from our own lives. You know, I'm like so many other people in spending way too much time engaged with screens. The real catalyst for me was a game that I was playing between New York and L.A., and I played for hours and hours on end. I just couldn't stop playing, and I remember landing and the person next to me saying, I saw that you were playing that one game for several hours in a row. Right. How did you manage that? And I remember thinking, I don't remember. The hours escaped me, and I lost them, and they could have been better used. And I started to see that that was true of lots of other people, and not just with games, but with all sorts of screen experiences. And then I dug deeper into it, and I realized there was something to this and that it hadn't been explored quite deeply enough.
You begin the book with the revelation that people like Steve Jobs, for example, who are creating these technologies, they actually feel uneasy about them in their own homes. Steve Jobs, for example, didn't want his kids – he said his kids never used the iPad. And this is something that – it interested you, and you find it troubling.
Yeah, I do find it troubling because whenever you see a big difference in the corporate world between something that a corporate exec is saying publicly and what they're doing privately, you have to ask why.
Yeah.
And in this case, this is not just about Steve Jobs. I'm not pointing the finger at one particular executive, but this is a widespread practice in the tech world There's a school in Silicon Valley, for example, that has it's a school that doesn't allow tech until the eighth grade. And when it does allow tech, it's really just to teach children how to program and how to develop apps and things like that. It's slow tech is basically what it's known as. And 75% of the kids at that school are the children of Silicon Valley tech execs. So we're talking about a fairly widespread issue. And given how common that is, I think we need to ask questions about what exactly it is that these tech giants know that leads them to want to keep their kids, to some extent, protected from these forms of tech.
Does that give you a sense that this may be a class issue in some way?
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, I think class and education are linked. And here, no one is better educated about these products than the people who are making them. And part of the reason for that is that they're very sophisticated. They have massive teams of people who are tweaking and engineering and amending behind the scenes so that what they ultimately unleash on the world is the very most addictive, most compelling version of their products. Mm. Now, if you have to watch that day in and day out and you're educated in that and very well compensated for it, it will turn out to be the case that the people who know the most about what these devices can do for the bad are the people who are wealthiest and who are best educated.
Early on in the book, you mentioned Greg Hochmuth.
Yes, that's right.
He's one of the first engineers for Instagram. And at some point in the process, he says he realized that he was building, here's how he put it, an engine for addiction. That this Instagram thing that he was working on had started to take on its own life. Now, here's part of the question. How intentional is it for people like Hochmuth and Jobs? Did they design it that way? Was that their intent? How intentional was all of this? Or did it just happen to be circumstance in some way, a coincidence?
I think it varies. It varies by company and it varies by the particular form of tech. I think in terms of gaming, the games are designed to function very much like a slot machine where you're constantly enticed to play because you never know what the outcome will be. You're given artificial goals. You're asked to pay money once you start playing to continue playing at a reasonable pace, things like that. I think a lot of the tech platforms that are released, the people releasing them don't use the language of addiction. They won't say, let's try to make this addictive. And obviously inherent in that is the idea that they're going to make people's lives worse off. They just say, this is a competitive marketplace. We're all competing for limited attention. We need to make the most engaging platform possible. So I can give some of them the benefit of the doubt on that they're just trying to make the best product possible, which happens to mean the product that you can't stop using over time. Mm. But then you do hear people like Hochmuth and former execs from Google and a number of other people talking about the fact that internally, at least some people are aware that what they're designing is an engine for addiction. They will use that term.
Mm. There's an app developer you write about, Kevin Hollish, who noticed in his own life that he was not spending enough time with his family. So he develops an app called Moment. And it was something that you downloaded. And the idea was to figure out how much time you're spending, I guess what, on your computer and on your phone. And you did this. You downloaded this. And you were really surprised. And I'm guessing most of us would be surprised, right?
I think so. I mean, one of the things that psychologists know is that our introspections are pretty fragile and not all that accurate a lot of the time. And I saw myself playing this game for hours on end and wondered, is that typical of my behavior or is that just because I was on a plane and what else was I going to do? Yeah. So I started to look for apps that might give me some sense of how much time I was spending. And I spoke to Hollish and I said to him, how accurate are people? How well do they know how much time they're spending and do they spend a lot? And he said, well, it's up to you to decide whether it's a lot, but everyone that he speaks to underestimates how much time they spend almost universally. Yeah. And they tend to underestimate by about 50%, which was my case. I thought I used my phone for maybe an hour a day, and that seemed like a lot. And I ended up using it for about 2.5 to 3 hours a day. I spoke to Hollish last week, actually, fairly recently, just to see if there was any update in the numbers. We spoke 2 years ago. And Americans, on average, were using their phones for 2 hours and 48 minutes a day. And he said last week, that's changed. It's now, instead of 2:48, it's now 3:42.
Wow.
So it's just in 2 years increased by an hour. And that's not a small amount, obviously. So these devices are sucking us in more and more across time.
Have you thought about, is there a healthy amount of time to be looking at a screen? What is a reasonable amount of, 3 hours is way too long, but what's a reasonable amount of time?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that there's a universally agreed upon rule of thumb. Largely, this is subjective. And if you ask yourself the question, am I using my phone too much? It should be pretty clear that the phone either is or is not getting in the way of some other important aspects of your life.
Yeah.
And so that's the biggest litmus test, I think. Some people say no, but actually the vast majority of people acknowledge that the phone at the dinner table has been a problem, or the phone when they're trying to have a conversation with a loved one or a friend, or that they are trying to go to bed at night and they end up spending 3 hours on the phone and suddenly it's 2 a.m., you know, things like that. These are almost universal experiences. So I think it's less about absolute numbers, although you're right. 4 hours a day, given how little free time we have during the work week, is an absurd amount of time.
Yeah. You write about this experiment, I think it was in 2013, where these psychologists asked people to come into this small room and just have a conversation. And there were two different groups. One group had their phone with them. The others didn't. Now explain what was the difference? What happened in those two different groups?
Yeah, you know, this is not a particularly strange situation. We meet strangers all the time and you're sitting across from them and having a conversation in some setting or another. And half of them, as you said, had a phone upside down on the table between them. It's not like the screen was blazing or anything like that. It was upside down. It wasn't actually active, but it was there. The other half, instead of that screen there, instead of the phone, they had a book placed in that spot. And then they just had a conversation, pretty free form. They had some ideas about what to discuss just to move things along. And at the end, they were asked, how much of a connection did you form? How friendly was this person? How engaged were you? How engaged were they? All very important metrics for social connection. And the researchers found that people felt much more connected, much more in the moment, much more present when there was no phone, when it was a book. The phone was sort of promising something more interesting in the outside world than this conversation could provide. And that meant that they were constantly drawn mentally out of that world and transported elsewhere. It made it very hard for them to stay in the moment and to develop a stream of conversation that was enriching for them.
Mm. What's the difference between a substance addiction, a drug addiction, and an addiction to your iPhone? Is there a difference?
Surprisingly little.
Yeah,
there's surprisingly little in all sorts of important ways. Obviously, the biggest difference, when I talk about behavioral addiction, which captures all of these new forms of addiction, they do not involve the ingestion of a substance, and that's an important difference.
Yeah.
There is no drug acting on your brain. There's no substance. But it's interesting to, first of all, to look at the brain, which responds very similarly to any pleasurable experience in the short term. You still get the same dopamine rush, the same dopamine binding to the same receptors, the same flush of pleasure. And that doesn't look very different between those cases, although that's also, you know, when a kid eats ice cream, you get the same thing.
Yeah.
So we need to look for more than that. But the real thing that I think is interesting is that what makes these experiences so addictive is that they scratch very urgent psychological itches for us. And those are things like boredom or loneliness or anxiety or depression or low self-esteem. It varies across people. For many, it's just that our boredom threshold is incredibly low, which is why you'll get into an elevator for literally 5 seconds. And that will be long enough for everyone to have decided that it's easier to get the phone out than to stand in silence.
I have to say, one of the things that I was most struck by in the book was this idea of loneliness, that you explained that we're becoming addicted to our screens because we're not connected to others. And in some way, it's relief from psychological pain is what you get at. And I wanted to ask you about that. Is this, you talk about it being loneliness and disaffection and distress, that screens somehow help with that. Does that say something about the larger human condition? Or have we always been lonely and disaffected and distressed?
I mean, I think there's always been an element of that, but I'd say that it's exaggerated today, and it's probably grown in the face of massive urbanization. And the way we live our lives now is very self-contained.
Yeah.
And that's certainly been more true recently than in evolutionary history, but even in more recent history, in the last 100 years, the way cities have developed is such that we are now solo. We go solo much of the time. Even if you have a family network, even if you have friends, you do spend an inordinate amount of time either alone or, for many of us, quite lonely. And screens are a really easy, quick fix to that problem, and we resort to them readily when that happens.
I want to ask you about the history of, this was interesting, the history of the word addiction. Originally, in ancient Rome, for example, addiction meant to be enslaved.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. It was this idea that you were a slave to some experience.
Yeah.
You could literally be enslaved by a person, but then it came to mean that you were, enslaved by some experience. It wasn't essentially a negative thing early on. It really just meant that you were really into something. You liked that thing a lot. You spent a lot of time thinking about it, and it brought you great pleasure. And over time, it evolved to have the meaning, much like we have today, where there needs to be some negative component there. In the long run, it's bad for you in some way.
Right.
Otherwise, we would say we were addicted to things like breathing because we can't stop breathing. But, of course, that's good for us. So it's developed this current definition probably about 100 years ago, and then over time it's broadened because even in the 60s and 50s, people thought you couldn't be addicted to things like nicotine,
right?
Because nicotine was legal. It was seen as an illicit thing. It had to be illegal. And now, obviously, it was controversial for a while, but now it's pretty widely accepted in the psychiatric community, in the community of psychiatrists and psychologists, that you've got a whole lot of addictions that don't involve substances at all. It really is a psychological response to some experience.
The first behavioral addicts were babies, you say. You tell the story from this gathering in New York City in 1968. Would you say something about that?
Yeah, this is a gathering of experts on a whole lot of different psychological issues, and they were some of the giants in the psychology world, very, very bright people. And one of the gentlemen there who's now recognized as one of the great psychologists of the 20th century, Jerome Kagan, he noticed that babies, when you held up certain images in front of them, couldn't stop looking at those images. It was a certain kind of line that he found they were really drawn to. It fascinated them. And he described that as a form of behavioral addiction. He said that they were addicted to looking at these pictures. Now, I would argue that his definition is pretty liberal. I'm not sure that looking at something without being able to stop is really addiction unless it's bad for you. And for those babies, it was just a matter of development.
Yeah.
But that's really the first time that term was used. And obviously it's a while ago, but it's grown in use since then.
But it also gets to the way obsession and compulsion come into play and passion, which is part of this too.
Yeah, passion is part of it. Passion's an interesting word because we often use it to describe something positive. And there are passions that are harmonious, known as harmonious passions, that work well with our lives. They fit in nicely. They have a spot that they occupy. And then we can leave them behind and move on with other aspects of our lives that are often very important, like interacting with other people and getting on with the business of work and exercise and things like that. But there are also another kind known as obsessive passions.
Yeah.
And those are passions that end up eating into other aspects of our lives. They become like addictions. They become all-consuming. And many of our passions today are obsessive. They do occupy a bigger part of our lives than they perhaps should.
We were talking earlier a bit about the history of addiction, and you mentioned how the first human addict may have been around 13,000 years ago. And you go down this list of, the betel nut, the cot leaf, the tobacco leaf, the coca leaf, how we've, throughout our history, had something that we've become addicted to. And I wanted to ask you, I guess the takeaway here is that we are willing to overlook the costs of something for the benefits of something. And in that sense, I suppose being addicted to the buzz of a betel nut, chewing a betel nut, is not much different from a phone, I guess, in that same sense.
Yeah, it's not that different. It's something that we find pleasurable enough that we're willing to overlook the long-term consequences. And that's really what it means to be human. We are fallible and we struggle with self-control issues. Self-control is essentially putting off something that's really great now for something that'll be better later on. That's the basic definition of it. And addiction does come down to a large extent to this failure of self-control. or the sense that we've learned that there's a way to cope with anything that's unpleasant in the short term with some fix that makes us feel good now, but that is bad for us in the long run. And that's true of the betel nut. It's true of all sorts of other substances, and it's certainly true of these newer behavioral addictions as well.
We're going to take a break here, and we're going to get to solutions. But give me a broad sense. The idea, can we coexist with our technology? We'll get to some of the solutions that you offer. But as you were writing the book, were there moments when you felt completely cynical about the prospect of coexisting?
Yeah, I think it's crazy not to be cynical, right? I think just looking at the rise of various forms of technology and screen use and how rapidly that's changed, even that change, that rise of an hour in how long we spend with our screens in the last 2 years, it's easy to be pessimistic, but I think there are ways of coexisting with technology. It just requires that we change the way we think of its role in our lives. And I think right now, to be completely frank, most people don't think about it. They're mindless about it, and they consume it because it's easy and fun and doesn't demand much of them. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book and why I think more people are talking about this issue, because this is a runaway train, and we're going to need to work out some way to deal with it. And right now, we aren't even thinking about it enough to be able to do that.
Adam Alter is with us. His book is Irresistible, The Rise of Addictive Technology in the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. We'll take a quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the NYU professor, Adam Alter. He's joining us to talk about how our addiction to technology works. His book explores the business and the psychology of irresistible technologies. The book is called Irresistible, The Rise of Addictive Technology in the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. He's joining us from a studio in New York City. There's a surprisingly simple technique that was discovered in 1987 by these Australian neurologists. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about this because this gives us a sense of the importance of goals.
Yeah. So goals, the idea behind goal setting is that you're taking something that seems overwhelming, that you don't know how to tackle, and you turn it into a series of bite-sized chunks that you can manage. And what the researchers discovered was that people with Parkinson's disease who struggle to take one step at a time, who often have a lot of movement issues and problems moving around, what he found was that if they threw something just in front of their feet, like a sock or some other object, they were able to walk over that sock or over that object. Somehow having that bite-sized goal in front of them meant that they were able to mobilize. And so he had one particularly enterprising patient, these doctors had, and the patient had a walking stick, and he basically turned the stick upside down. And he'd put the stick just in front of his foot each time he wanted to take a step, and he would walk over the stick. And he'd repeat that action over and over and over again. And it basically meant that though he could not get from one side of a room to another without help, with the help of this stick, which made these little bite-sized goals, this little hurdle, he was able to get from place to place. And it just showed the power of these goals in even overcoming something as profound as a particular movement disorder. And of course, that then extends to how we use bite-sized goals in our lives more broadly and how compelling they are.
You write about your own experience running the New York City Marathon a few years ago and how you had a goal in mind and it gave you this reserve of willpower just having this goal.
Yeah, that's right. It's funny when you're running a marathon, I say this having only run one marathon, but I could tell you that my experience was pretty rough. I had a hard time. I think a lot of people do. But people say to you, don't run too hard in the beginning because you'll hit the wall. And the idea with the wall, obviously, as the metaphor would suggest, is that you essentially can't really go on, that physically you're spent. And that happened to me. I was maybe, 5 or 6 miles from the end of the run. Yeah. And a friend of mine ran onto the course. He'd been watching and he came on and he just patted me on the back and he said, you're doing well. He could see I was struggling. And he said to me, you're doing well. It looks like you're going to run the marathon in about 4:05. So just keep going. You're doing really nicely. And I remember being devastated because I'd been trying to run. One of my goals was under 4 hours. Yeah. I don't know why that seemed so important, why, say, 359 felt so different from 400 or 401, but it really did, and it drove me. And I was so upset about that that I put on the afterburners, despite having hit that wall, and I ran quite a lot faster for the rest of the race, finished in 357. And I remember being angry with my friend and saying, why did you tell me that if I was under the mark? And I remember he said to me, you know, you were close. I thought you'd go under four, but I worried that you'd slow down and be disappointed. He knew the power of telling me that I was just outside that goal. And he was right. It drove me on even when I was exhausted.
So you have goals. We have feedback. We have motivated perception. Talk about how they all come together to get us, I guess, get us addicted. And how does that idea of a goal, how does that play out in an app or in a addiction to a screen?
Well, goals are everywhere, and the designers of various platforms will inject them into our experiences. So you'll have a game where the goal might be to complete all the levels or to get all the coins in the game or to reach some sort of status level. A lot of games have status. You know, you can become a level X, level 99, level 87, whatever, and you want to reach those different goals. And as you reach one, you want the next one.
Yeah.
You also have feedback in the form of sending information out in Twitter and Instagram and Snapchat and Facebook and sending out emails, wondering what's going to come back. All of that has a certain uncertainty built into it that makes us really focused and interested. And humans are fascinated by uncertainty where there's a possibility of reward. It's more interesting to us than certain reward. So we'll get bored of always succeeding quite quickly, surprisingly fast, given how much we want success. Yeah. And if you build in some uncertainty, which is inherent in any experience we have with other people or online, that uncertainty will drive us on. And that's why we are so compelled by checking Facebook. How many likes have I got? How many friends have I got? How many people commented? How many shared?
Yeah.
And so on with all of these social networks. So that when you infuse an experience with enough of these hooks, it becomes very, very hard to move on and to leave it behind. And it ends up occupying this fairly large part of our minds.
Because there's no end to it.
The bottomlessness of these experiences is a huge factor. I think if you think about the way we consumed media for a very long time, there were stopping rules built in. A stopping rule is basically an occasion where you're told you are at this point, do you want to continue? And it's subtle, but it comes from the outside. When you're reading a book, it happens every time you end a chapter or get to the end of a paragraph or a section. It's true when you finish a TV episode and you have to wait till the following week. These stopping rules are a big part of how we lived our lives until fairly recently. But Facebook feeds are endless. Mm-hmm. Twitter feeds are endless. Instagram feeds go on forever. Email never ends. Text messaging never ends. There's very little that we do now. Even the way we consume media, like TV, you can watch TV episodes online and that one episode will move into the next one. Often the whole season is released at once. So the stopping rules that used to guide us to move on to the next thing have been eradicated. And in their place, we just keep doing things over and over again without our bodies saying to us, okay, maybe it's time to move on.
So binge watching a Netflix show or listening to a podcast, there's a kind of a cliffhanger engine built into that. And I'm wondering, does that go to the fact that we're not allowing ourselves delayed gratification anymore?
Yeah, I think so. I really think that's right. So the cliffhanger engine you mentioned is this idea that humans hate an open loop. We want every loop to be closed.
Yeah.
If you tell people half a story and then say, oh, I'm sorry, I can't divulge, I'm going to have to move on, or I realize that this is a secret, they'll freak out. They hate that. They really want to know what the answer is. And this is something that developers of all sorts of media will capitalize on. And that's the way cliffhangers in TV shows worked. And historically, that made sense, right? If you had a week between episodes, you wanted people to want to return the next week to watch.
Yeah.
But when you have just a whole lineup of shows that you can watch one after another, episodes lined up back to back, cliffhangers just mean that you don't stop. You end up binge watching. And so a good 6 or 7 out of 10 adults say that that's what happens for them, that they end up watching far more than they'd like to, just because there's no rule or no indication that, hey, maybe it's time to stop.
It seems like in some ways it's an issue of self-control. I was really interested in you write about this thing called hardship inoculation. Say something about that. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, it's this idea that we get better at things because we experience difficulty. We need a little bit of difficulty, not major hardship,
yeah,
but some hardship. when we talk about inoculation, you know, you think about how you inoculate yourself against serious diseases with vaccinations, and they give you a taste of the disease, or they give you a small dose so that your body then learns how to fight a bigger dose if one were to come along later on. The same is true about small doses of hardship. And just an example of this, I was thinking back to what it was like for me as a child of the 80s. And I remember that I could do something that I think many of us now consider superhuman if you meet someone who can do this today. I remembered probably 100 phone numbers without any effort.
Yeah.
Every kid did. We all knew our friends' numbers, our family members' numbers. We just did that automatically, and we learned to do it. And I think it made us different mental beings from the beings today who store all those phone numbers on phones. If you are asked to remember something today or memorize it, you will be worse off because you don't have those 100 numbers stored in your head, because you don't have that facility honed and ready to go. And that's a big part of self-control as well, is learning how to deal with the hardship of saying no, or having to overcome boredom, for example, is a really big one. You know, we just don't have a tolerance for boredom the way we once did. And boredom is where really interesting things start to happen, where creativity starts to bud and flourish. Without it, if everything's easy, if you're on this highway from point A to point B every time you think or every time you engage in an activity, you will never take the interesting off-ramps that get you to places that you couldn't have predicted ahead of time.
Yeah.
I think that's changing the way our mental universes are structured.
You and your wife had your first child not so long ago. And I'm wondering what influence that's had on the way you've been thinking about this. I think about this, for example, the idea of boredom. You want your kids to be bored from time to time. You must have thought about that during this process.
I've thought about it a lot, actually. It's been fascinating for me, the timing of the arrival of my son, who's now just over a year old, that when I started writing the book, I wasn't that focused on kids and teens because I just didn't have any in my life that I'd watched grow and mature. And watching my son, even at a very young age, interact with tech, even unintentionally, was fascinating to me. I remember when he was 4 months old, he reached over and he swiped my phone accidentally with his little flailing paw. And he swiped a phone, the screen image changed, and he looked at me with wonder. This was one of the greatest moments of his young life, and he smiled. I think it was the first time I remember him smiling.
Yeah.
And for me, that was a wonderful moment, but I also realized at that point just how well-designed these forms of tech are and how important it is, I think, to ensure that kids don't have that easiness all the time available to them. I've tried to keep him away from phones ever since, and I don't use my phone around him at all. And I think you're right about the boredom piece as well, that it's really important for kids to learn how to be bored. There's a really fascinating study from a few years ago where young people were led into a room, just a psychology experiment. They were college students, and they'd had a lot of time on social media, most of them. And they were asked to experience a brief shock, an electric shock. It's not very painful, but it doesn't feel great. You know, there are better things than feeling an electric shock.
Right.
And then they were told to wait for 20 minutes with their own thoughts while the next phase of the experiment was created. They weren't allowed to use their phones or anything, so they were sitting there. We don't sit quietly for 20 minutes much anymore. And the experimenters said to them, by the way, in case you'd like, in the corner of the room is that machine that gave you the shock earlier. If you want to go and test it again and play with it, you're welcome to do that. So this is a really interesting situation where they were asked to decide between the pain of experiencing the electric shock again, and they knew it was painful because they'd experienced it earlier, or just sitting quietly with their thoughts. Now, more than half of them decided that it was more painful to just sit with their thoughts because they walked over to the machine and they administered that shock again. Some of them did it over and over again.
Wow.
And when later asked what they were doing, they said, I hate being bored so much that it's more interesting for me to engage with this machine despite the pain. That's how we now treat boredom.
What's happening to the attention span, or the human attention span? It's diminishing. We can measure this.
Yeah, it is. It is diminishing. It's there are a number of techniques for measuring sort of resting attention, like how much attention do people dole out to something that's moderately interesting but doesn't take up too much of their interest and time. And there's some sense that our attention spans have declined in certain research pieces by about half. And in fact, the really recent research suggests that it's declined so much that one study said that we have an attention span of 8 seconds, which is frightening when you consider that goldfish have an attention span of about 9 seconds on average.
Adam Alter is with us. His book is Irresistible: The Rise of Addictive Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. We'll take another quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with Adam Alter. We're talking about his book, Irresistible, The Rise of Addictive Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. One of the things you write about are the cultural differences. The West, for example, treats this differently than say China. Talk about the different approaches in different cultures, different parts of the world.
Yeah, there's more of an epidemic, I think, in China among teens who are addicted to games in particular, but also other forms of internet use. Yeah. It does happen here, but it doesn't rise to the level of a medical issue just quite as often. It seems to more in East Asia, and so what they have in a number of East Asian countries now are sort of military boot camps. They're inpatient camps where parents will drop their children off for sometimes 3 or 4 months, and they'll undergo a regime of treatment that is of dubious benefit, but some of them will emerge not playing games at least for a while and not engaging with tech for a while, partly because when you spend 4 months not doing something, you end up developing new interests and ideas and you do tend to move on. It's a sort of basic detox approach. But this is something that I don't think would fly here. You couldn't imagine people dropping their children off and having them experience a sort of military lifestyle for 4 months as they're effectively having their tech addictions drilled out of them. And that's just the way it seems to be done in China, at least.
China was the first country, you say, to call this addiction a clinical disorder. The Western approach has been different, as you say, more scattered. But you say in the book that the point is not to, for example, medicalize all of this, but to, as you put it, alter the structure of how we live. What do you mean?
Yeah, that's very important. That I think when you talk about addiction, people gravitate towards medicine and they'll imagine that you're saying that this is something we all need treatment for. And that's just not true. It's not baked into the definition. It doesn't have to be medical. I think 1 to 5% of people roughly have probably what would be considered a medical behavioral addiction where they do need some sort of treatment. But research suggests that the other 45 or 50% of us that have these addictions, it's really just a structural issue. It's a matter of reorganizing our lives and perhaps changing the norms in the population at large about how we think tech should function in our lives. Mm. And that needs to happen. It needs to be a wholesale change in how we think about tech because, for example, to have a large company that demands that its employees respond to emails at all hours of the night, that's problematic. That shouldn't be acceptable. And indeed, in parts of the world, Western Europe in particular, France and Germany are very advanced in this respect. They actually, in France, recently passed a law suggesting that any company with more than 50 employees has to have a charter drawn up between the employer and the employees explaining how those employees will be protected from email between, say, 6 p.m. and 8 a.m., the after hours, so that they get a break from email. And that's really a matter of the culture changing, sometimes driven by government legislation. But that's something that I think we really need to pay attention to.
You make this comparison in the book between different attitudes about sex in different places in the United States, for example, how more traditional values tend to drive sexual expression underground. Like teens are more likely to have unprotected sex in conservative parts of the country, for example. Now, talk about the connection there for behavioral addictions for screens.
Well, the simple argument that we should go cold turkey on tech doesn't make sense. Yeah. And this is one great example that if you tell teens to abstain, you simply say to them, you should abstain, and you push them very hard to do that, they struggle to do it because you're not addressing the underlying issue, which is that teens biologically are driven to explore those issues.
Yeah.
And so if you don't treat the underlying issue, but you tell it to go underground, it ends up finding other ways to emerge. And that's problematic with respect to sex education, but it's also problematic when you try to just stop using tech altogether. If, as we mentioned earlier, that there are issues that people are treating with tech addiction, things like loneliness and boredom and anxiety and depression, if you don't deal with those issues but you just tell them to stop using tech, they'll turn to some other form of solution. And there was actually a really interesting article in the New York Times recently showing that the rate of teen drug use had declined because many of the teens who used to turn to drugs are now turning to social media. Yeah. It's arguably one positive byproduct of the social media era that the teens are turning to a slightly less dangerous form of addiction.
I wanted to ask you about some of the you list three qualities of healthy screen time. And I wanted to go through these, if you would. First, you say encourage your kids to connect what they see in the screen with the real world. Explain that.
Yeah, that's very important. It's especially important for kids because if you have people who grew up where there were no screens, many of us, older people today, we had an era that a lot of us think about nostalgically as this era pre-screen. We know that there is such thing as life without screens and that screens are sort of an appendage that have been added onto our lives now.
Yeah.
For young kids, they don't really know that. They don't know that screens have that function. And what often happens is they see the screen world as its own genuine separate universe, a universe that's more fun, more vivid, a place they can escape to. But if you integrate screens into the real world and you show, for example, a young child who's watching Sesame Street and learning about the color red, hey, look, let's do the laundry together. Here are some red socks and shirts and shorts and things. The child will learn that it's just really an extension of the real world. It's not its own genuine universe. And that's really important, especially with young kids, that they don't start to see it as a separate thing from the rest of their lives.
Here's another one. Active engagement is better than passive viewing.
Yeah, this really does get back to the issue of boredom and our hardship inoculation and the idea that so much of our time now is spent in this mental passivity where we're just not engaged with the world around us.
Yeah.
And it's especially a problem with watching passive media and so much of what we're doing when we're surfing online, when we're going onto apps and dealing with social media and reading emails is very passive. We're not doing much. But there are certain programs, especially for young kids, that do encourage them to engage. They have to participate or they're encouraged to do that. And those programs tend to be much better for them. They tend not to lead to quite the same degrees of cognitive decline as you might find if you're just passive most of the day.
And then say something about this third one. You say screen time should focus on the content of the app, not the technology itself.
Yeah. So if you're talking about, as I mentioned with the Sesame Street example earlier, if you're talking about the color red on Sesame Street, it shouldn't be about watching the screen. It should be about the color red. It should be about the thing that they're describing, what they're teaching the child about. And the best way to do that is to make it about more than just the screen, to go beyond the bounds of the screen and to focus on that content outside of the screen world when the screen time is over. And so time and time again, if your child's learning about the color red, you should remind them of the color red in the real world when you happen to see it. You pass a red car in the street, you see some red object, you go to the fruit market, you see some fruit that's red colored. Talk about that as well. And that's really important because it makes it about the content rather than the vehicle of delivery, which is one of the big problems with screens is that they come to be seen as this sort of separate vehicle of delivery, this separate way of consuming the world and engaging with the world.
Seems like the larger point is on all of these cases is parents have to engage with their kids. They have to be watching, being with them when they're engaged in technology. They can't just, you know, hand them the iPad and walk away.
Yeah, and it's so easy to do that. I when I wrote most of the book, I didn't realize how hard it was to be a parent. I imagined but hadn't experienced it. And it's challenging at times. There are times when having a crutch like a screen is really appealing. And if you could just get your child to watch a show for the next couple of hours, it would make your life much easier. I'm not going to be puritanical about this and say that you should never do that. But the American Association of Pediatrics has suggested that kids shouldn't really watch screens until they're 18 months to 2 years of age. And I'm doing my very best with my son to do that, to keep him away from screens at least for a little while, and then to be mindful about what he's watching when he does watch. So I just think it pays to be mindful. I'm not saying we shouldn't do it at all, but being careful about it, I think, is really important.
You write this in your book. You write, how far are you from your phone right now? Can you reach it without moving your feet? Talk a little bit about this idea of psychological and physical distance to our phones, to our screens. That seems an important part of this.
Yeah. It's hard to be addicted to something in the long run if you can't reach it,
right,
if it's not near you. And one of the things that's true about screens, people always say, well, you know, there's always some curmudgeon who's angry about tech. There's someone who's angry about TVs when they came out and pinball machines and whatever else. Why is this different? I think one of the reasons it's different, and there are many, but one of them is that phones, if you ask most people, are things that never leave their side. They can reach them 24 hours a day without having to move their feet. And there are studies showing this, that a lot of people, over 70% of people now sleep next to their phones. They have their phones in their pockets most of the day or in their bags. They don't have to move their feet to reach them. And that makes them a great vehicle for delivering information at all times, a great vehicle for delivering advertising content, games, social networking, email. And since we arm them with notifications, with dings and beeps and flashing lights and badges and icons, we're basically giving these phones an incredible amount of control over our lives. We're basically saying to them, just let me know when you want me to pay attention to you again. And on average, they do that every few minutes. So it doesn't make sense for us to give them that much power. The best thing is to reduce how – to increase the distance or reduce how much time we spend so close to them.
In the book, you mention a number of different technologies that could be helpful in shaping behavior in good ways. I wanted to ask you about a couple of these. Snooze and Lose is an app or a technology that helps shape behavior with these small punishments.
Yeah, Snooze and Lose is one of my favorite examples. I think it's also got a sort of comical element to it. But what it does is it's an alarm clock. And like many alarm clocks, there is a snooze button. But normally the cost of hitting the snooze button is minimal. What Snooze and Lose does is it's automatically connected to your bank account. And it will automatically deduct a certain amount of money, say $10, every time you hit the snooze button. But here's the real kicker. It doesn't send that money somewhere appealing. It sends it to a cause that you do not support.
Right.
It could be the other political party that you don't support. It could be some other random cause that you find you don't want to support for whatever political or personal or attitudinal reasons you have. And it does a good job of controlling your behavior because you're infusing the world with some sort of negative feedback when you don't do the thing you want to be doing. It's a good way of getting your morning self to behave the way your evening self would like it to behave by building in this form of automatic punishment.
You had your own invention, or at least you wanted to have an invention, this tiny alarm clock. you said you haven't actually made it work, but it's interesting. You've been thinking about your own kind of invention.
Yeah, it's more of an idea than something I could imagine being built, partly because I don't know how it would work. But
right.
I was talking to a Nobel Prize-winning economist and psychologist, Danny Kahneman, who was at Princeton when I was a grad student there. And we were talking about how you can get people to think about the things that are important in life. Because the way humans generally work is that they like to coast along mentally without really engaging. It's their favorite mode, is just to glide along thinking just as hard as they need to make their lives workable. But every now and again, there's a message where you really want them to engage, where you need them to think, to deviate from the default, to get a little bit more deeply engaged with the process. And we talked about this sort of alarm clock that would pop up and say to you, hey, now is the time. You need to think about this thing. I came up with a number of other little ideas that had the same effect. For example, if you want people to think about something, if you write the message in a font that's hard to read, it forces them to slow down and read the message more clearly and carefully. So they tend to think more deeply about it. That's the sort of mental version of this alarm. But that is a really important thing in this day and age where you're greeted with thousands of messages every day. How do you know where to apportion your energy? You can't possibly process all of them. And that's one of the things that I think would be really nice to have is a guy that says, hey, here's the thing you should really pay attention to.
Not all addictive experiences, you say, are bad. In fact, if you can't eliminate an addiction, which apparently we can't, then we should try and harness it. And gamification is something you write about. Say something about that. This is sort of putting the positive spin on addiction, I guess.
Yeah, I would argue that it's the same engine that drives addiction that could drive healthier and happier behaviors. And therefore, I wouldn't call it addiction so much as a behavior that you do over and over again, but that ends up having good effects on your life.
Yeah.
I'm talking about things that we're really not very good at doing, like saving money or just eating well, exercising, all the things that we'd prefer not to do. Gamification is the idea that you turn these behaviors into a game. You make them, you infuse them with some of the elements of games that make games so addictive and hard to resist. There are classic examples of this. There's this example of kids who hate brushing their teeth. I've experienced this now. They'd rather go to sleep if they're tired, and if they're not, they'd rather play than brush their teeth. Philips Sonicare introduced this program that was paired with some of their kids' toothbrushes, where there's a little character called a Sparkly who dances around as you're brushing your teeth as a child. And kids love watching Sparkly dance, and so they brush their teeth. It actually encouraged them to brush their teeth. And this was so effective that they just wouldn't stop. They had to actually build in a two-minute time limit where the Sparkly goes to sleep, tucks himself into bed and says, I think it's time for us to stop and move on. That's just how effective gamification can be in encouraging the right behaviors to the point where they become obsessive. So it's a powerful tool that needs to be wielded pretty carefully.
Let me ask you finally, you mentioned some solutions. You talked earlier about having workplaces disable email accounts at night. That could help. You also mentioned games can be built with chapters that give natural stopping points as opposed to binging. You mentioned social media platforms can demetricate, you know, remove the numerical feedback, and then introducing screens more slowly. Do you think it will work? I mean, these addictions are so powerful. Do you think we have the will to change our attitude?
Yeah, I do. I don't think it's about willpower, because willpower will fail. Yeah. It'll fail every time because we're human. You can try, and for a while you might succeed if you have some willpower. But the trick is to change the way our environments are engineered in the first place, to change either the way the games are produced by these large corporations or the platforms are produced, or to change the way we engage with them. And the thing that we have control as consumers over right now is how we engage. We need to carve out time that's sacred every day where we don't have screens and tech around us. That way you're not trying to resist temptation 24 hours a day. You're actually creating a period of time where there is no temptation in the first place. And we need to encourage that. We need to do more of that, to remove the push notifications and remove the dings and bells and buzzes that keep us engaged, so that we have more time to say, this is what I'm going to do right now and why I want to do it, rather than being told by devices and screens, now's the time to pay attention. And I think with those tweaks, we do have the ability to coexist with these forms of tech in a way that is actually much healthier than the way we're mostly engaging with them now.
That's Adam Alter. He's a professor of psychology and marketing at the Stern School of Business at New York University. His book is Irresistible: The Rise of Addictive Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. He joined us from a studio in New York City. Adam Alter, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thanks so much for having me on the show, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction today from Adrian Moranville. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.